The Sage of Emporia. The famed editor of the Emporia Gazette, the friend and confidant of President Theodore Roosevelt. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR presents William Allen White at 150. This year marks the 150th anniversary of the birth of Kansas's most famous journalist. The University of Kansas School of Journalism is marking the occasion with a number of activities next week, one of which is the premiere of a new film by KU's own Kevin Wilmot. Kevin, thank you for coming in today. It's always great to see you.
Oh, thank you, Kay. Appreciate it.
Many of us Kansans think we already know about William Allen White. Why do a film about him now?
Well, I think, you know, I grew up in Kansas, and as a kid, I heard about him. But they always told you he was important, but they didn't really tell you what he was important about, really. And they said he was a journalist, but they didn't really tell you why was he such a special journalist. And so the film really shows you that, I think. He's a really important figure in a lot of different ways. I've really kind of fallen in love with him. He took on a lot of important powers at a time that was really a really critical, crucial time in Kansas history. And he took them on, you know, as a journalist. And he kind of played a politician, but he really wasn't a politician. That was the form he took that really take them on. But the Klan was taking over the United States in the 1920s. And they were about to take over Kansas. They had already taken over Indiana. They'd taken over much of the South. And they were on its way to take over Kansas. And William Allen White really took them on as his journalistic self, but he also really ran for governor just to really address specifically the danger and threat of the Klan. And I just feel like Kansas would have been a very, very different state if he hadn't done that.
You know, when I was in college, I wrote an honors thesis about the rise of the Klan in the 1920s. I think that's a chapter of American history that most Americans are woefully ignorant about.
No doubt about it. And it has a lot of connections to today, you know, that it was it kind of comes out of populism. It comes out of a threat of immigrants. And now, obviously, in Kansas, the threat wasn't so much blacks because there were not enough blacks really, you know, African-Americans weren't a buff of a population to really be a real threat. So really the threat was Catholics. And Catholics were immigrants. I mean, they were Italians and you know, Europeans. And so the Klan was about... the Klan was like the Kiwanis and the Elks Club at that time. They were just a normal organization. I mean, they you know, you would drive into a Kansas town and you see the Elks Club sign and the Kiwanis and the Klan. And it was just that normal. I mean, the 4th of July parade, you know, they would march down the street like any other civic organization. And I remember my father specifically telling me stories. My father, you know, was born in 1898, and he was, you know, a young man during this time. And he would say, you know, 4th of July, they would march down the street, and you would notice who was wearing, who the shoes were, and you would know, oh, that's Mr. Johnson down the store, because I know his shoes. So, I mean, it was just a normal, normal world. And if White had not taken on the Klan at that time, because it was so normal, it was such an everyday kind of thing. If he hadn't kind of exposed the threat of them, I think we'd be different, living in a different Kansas right now.
So why do you think it was, if we had sort of a, I'm using air quotes here, a normalized Ku Klux Klan, what was it about that that made him think, no, this isn't normal. We need to do something about this.
Well, he had really kind of come into his own after World War One. And after World War One, you know, he starts out really being very conservative with what's the matter with Kansas, the essay that makes him famous. And then after World War One, you know, World War One really was a lot of violations of civil rights and civil liberties and the First Amendment during that time. I mean, they arrested people who were against the war. I mean, it's just Eugene Debs is probably the best example of that. And White really kind of evolved from that. He really kind of got it from that whole thing. And when he went overseas, and he found out that America had been harder on on its agitators than even the Europeans had, where the war existed. So he really came back kind of a different person and really kind of saw it differently. And so I think from that, that's how he sees the Klan. He starts to really realize that these threats to democracy and these threats to civil liberties, and that's when the whole issue of civil liberties really first started to come about. And so he just kind of, you know, between his journalistic kind of, you know, world and his political world, and Theodore Roosevelt, again, was a real big influence on him with this. But between those things and really, I think, just his upbringing that he had with his mother specifically, who kind of enlightened him about race to some degree. And he kind of just put it all together that this was something that was going to be a real threat to the state.
Do you know why it was that his mother was sort of clued into that?
Well, she saw the Lincoln-Douglas debate at Knox College. That's where she went to Knox College. And she saw the debate. And so she fell in love with Abraham Lincoln. And falling in love with Abraham Lincoln really meant that you had to become an abolitionist, basically. And so she was an abolitionist. And so when she was in Emporia, in the El Dorado area, she tried to get blacks, to African Americans, to be part of her class, and they wouldn't let her. And she actually got fired because she was kind of secretly teaching African Americans.
You say being part of a class, you mean like she was trying to integrate them
into
schools?
She was an elementary school teacher, yeah, and they fired her because she was teaching blacks.
That must have been considered a really kind of out there opinion at the time.
No doubt about it. I mean, it just, you know, I mean, she's doing the thing that we really don't officially start doing in America as a whole until like the 60s, the late 50s, right? So, I mean, she, you know, they were a progressive type of family in a lot of ways, specifically mom and her influence on white. And that just kind of carries over into, I think, all the things he ended up doing.
Kevin, what kind of challenges did you have in telling this story?
Well, you know, the big challenge is, you know, deciding what to leave out. You know, I mean, he's got a big life, and the focus I wanted to make on the film was really the conflict that he has, political and social. But he's an interesting person, period. You know, his everyday life is really interesting, and the fact that he stayed in Emporia, the fact that choice, I think, really kind of heightens democracy. You know, I think, you know, several of the historians that we have in the film mention how, you know, when you live in a small town, it really kind of elevates your understanding of democracy, because in the big city you understand the big picture in a sense, but in the small town you have to deal with people. You can't escape folks in the small town, you know, and they're going to be in your face if you're doing things that they don't like. And so you have to really have to learn. It's the really the village kind of concept. You have to learn how to deal with folks. And I think that's one of the things that probably affected him with the Klan, you know, was that, you know, these were people, he knew everybody in town and everybody knew him, and they could meet him on the street and say, hey, I don't like this. And when he does What's the Matter with Kansas, it's because he's literally walking down the street and the populist guys kind of start harassing him. And so, you know, in the small town, you can't escape democracy. You have to kind of deal with it.
But it also works the other way around, that people in that small town knew him and challenged his thoughts.
No doubt about it. And I think that probably made him a bigger, better person for it, too. You know, it does go both ways. And the harassment that he got, I think, just really made him understand that, there's a lot of different voices here and a lot of different opinions on things. And it wasn't as easy to just dismiss groups of people as it is in the big city, because you never see those people. I mean, you're so far removed from folks that, you know, these people are against what you're saying, but I'll never have to deal with them.
Kevin, this is quite a departure from some of your previous films, like Confederate States of America, Jayhawkers, Chirac.
Yeah, it is a bit. You know, I'm always interested in Kansas stories. I think Kansas stories that specifically kind of have the bigger picture. I mean, Kansas, there's a Mark McCormick, who is one of our kind of historians in the film. He talks about how Kansas has this noble narrative. And the noble narrative of Kansas is, you know, the Free State, John Brown, Topeka versus Board of Education case. I mean, Kansas is often the place that is the, you know, White would talk about how it happens in Kansas first. And I think that's kind of true. I mean, and from that fact, this noble narrative has kind of evolved from it. And that's one of the reasons I love living in Lawrence, because Lawrence is kind of the base of the noble narrative, you know, that this is where it all kind of comes from and ends up here in one way or another. And White is a big part of that. I mean, White is kind of the unknown element of the noble narrative, and that, you know, that's why I talk so much about in the film about the Klan issue, because without White taking on the Klan, the noble narrative that we kind of take for granted in Kansas, that, you know, we weren't as bad as Missouri or other, you know, southern states, that wouldn't be the rule, because Kansas had plenty of problems of its own. But the noble narrative always kind of seemed, there was always an opposition group to the bad elements. There was always an opposition to slavery or racism or something. And because of that, we have this noble narrative. And that's I think that's a really beautiful thing.
Kevin, I'm going to challenge you there for a second, because I kind of feel like that noble narrative is a fiction that we tell ourselves about Kansas, that we have this story in our mind that we do have this noble past, but the truth of it is the reality was way more complicated.
No doubt about it. I mean, the specific what I mean about the noble narrative is that there was always opposition to the bad thing. There was always opposition to the racist kind of things. Typically, it involved race, you know. And, you know, John Brown is not from Kansas, but he came to Kansas. And the abolitionists that founded Lawrence are here. And they embrace Brown. And Brown has the big effect that he has in this area during the Bleeding Kansas, because those few abolitionists are here, and it's always a small group of folks. It's not the base. It's not the people in power. It's typically a small group of people who are fighting against the odds against this other thing that's really against democracy in various ways, and that's why it's a noble narrative, because they're, you know, they always kind of prevailed. It seemed like they always prevailed in some kind of way.
In doing this film, what's the most surprising thing you learned about William Allen White?
You know, I didn't really know how he evolved. I mean, you know, I think people take for granted that he just got it from the beginning. You know, he just was there, and it's like, oh, he's just a great man. No, he had to evolve. And when he started out, he was very, very, very conservative. And typically what that meant in those days, well, he said it himself, he thought he was part of the ruling class of the state. And he wasn't thinking about others very much. And so those populists that harass him on the street in Emporia, he really ends up being friends with them in the end. And Teddy Roosevelt, they were just ahead of their time. Teddy Roosevelt and other influences that come down the line just a little bit later basically end up telling him, those guys on the street that harassed you, they were right. And so he ends up being friends with Sockless Jerry Simpson and all these guys that he was dogging out in the essay, What's the Matter with Kansas? He ends up being friends with those guys and ends up the rest of his life really kind of fighting for the values that those guys were really talking about. That's a pretty amazing thing. You don't hear that story much anymore today. I mean, folks are either this or they're that, you know, and they never change. You know, events never influenced them to kind of turn into someone else. You know, you're either on the left or you're on the right. And so that story, I think, is a good lesson for us today that you know, we can evolve and we can learn from our surroundings and we can, you know, and learn from the lives of others, you know, which is, I think, the big thing.
You know, that's a really interesting point, because I think in this day when so much of what we do is documented either through social media or just through the media, that there's a tendency to say, well, you said this 10 years ago or you wrote this 20 years ago. And And either you're lying now or you're flip-flopping and you're wishy-washy rather than being able to accommodate the idea that people can change their minds, that people can have experiences that change their perspective.
That's the people who call on that on white all the time. They'll say, you said this years ago and you said this then. And he said consistency was just a joke. And that's true, because if you're really part of the democratic experiment, if you really are engaged in the world of democracy in the United States, you're going to have various opinions at various times. And you know, I mean, that doesn't mean that his core values were you know, just manipulated or could just go back and forth. No, the things he believed in. But you can see the other side of the story at times on different things. And certainly you can be wrong at times. And that's, to me, the big one in American life now. That you can never be wrong. No one can ever admit, hey, look, I just didn't get it at that time. I was into a hole in the bag and I just didn't see it. That's okay. That's okay to say. And Americans would probably be beneficial to us to kind of accept that more and to be interested in that more.
So your film, William Allen White, What's the Matter with Kansas? Do you focus on, say, the 1920s, that era of his life?
Well, I try to take his whole life as much as I can. It's really a biography, there's several chapters that, you know, in movies you have to concentrate on the conflict, and so, you know, his conflict with the Klan is probably the big one. But he takes on John R. Brinkley, the Go Klan doctor, and you know, that's a funny tale, but it's also a very serious tale.
People spent thousands of dollars and put their health at risk for this quote-unquote treatment.
Yes, and even the bigger threat beyond just the fact that he's putting gold glands in human beings is that he won the governorship of Kansas, but they just didn't give it to him. I mean, they just said if you didn't sign the ballot, because it was a write-in ballot, if you didn't sign it, J.R.
Right.
Brinkley, the vote doesn't count, and he would have won if they'd counted all the votes that really came in for him. And it lets you know that he was mad. He was insane. And someone insane could have been the governor of Kansas. And it lets you know, and that's what White's point was, that demagogues, and he was anti-Semitic, and he was, you know, he was not just crazy with the goat gland thing. He was saying all kind of other racist kind of crazy things on his radio.
On the radio.
And so, you know, how White sees is that he's a threatening demagogue, and this is a threat to democracy, and that people that are extreme like that, who can sell racism, who can sell division, who can sell, you know, corruption, because in the other part of the goat gland thing, it's corruption, and they can become leaders and powerful, you know, folks in the country, and you've got to stop them before they go too far, and that's what White's point was.
Like I said, it's the 150th anniversary of William Allen White's birth. What do you think his life has to say to us now?
Well, that's the thing I'm hoping that's in the film, is that I think he is he's a reminder that you have to be vigilant, and you can't take democracy for granted, and you have to be an educated really citizen, and if you're not an educated citizen, you can fall for Dr. John Brinkley, and you can fall for the Klan. And you can fall for these things that are sold to us as normal. He had a powerful radio. Brinkley had a powerful radio station. The Klan was speaking to people at a time of transition. They're coming out of a war, and the economy is bad, and all these things are going on. And so racism and xenophobia and all these things are easy sells to people during that time. And so, you know, White is this constant drumbeat, this constant reminder that, you know, democracy includes everyone. And in democracy, if you can't give democracy to everyone, no one gets it. And your job is to try to give justice to everyone, and ensuring that it ensures it for yourself. And you can't be selfish with these values, that you have to try to really share them with others is one of his big, big, big themes. And I just think that has a lot to do with today, that you know, there's a lot of selfishness going on right now in various ways in American life, in leadership in various ways. And that's a real threat to democracy, because if you don't, you know, if you're not willing to share it, you don't get to really have it.
One of the most tragic chapters in the life of William Ellen White was, of course, the untimely death of his beloved daughter, Mary. Did you address that in your film?
Yes, we do. And it is probably the big, you know, that's the big, you know, sad part of his life, really. And, you know, Mary is, I mean, White would have been considered a feminist at that time, you know. I mean, he wouldn't necessarily be considered a feminist today, but he was a pretty progressive guy, pretty advanced. And in his treatment of women, he had a lot of women friends. He had a lot of women that, authors and different people that he really helped their careers in various ways. And his daughter was kind of the product of that. I mean, she was a very advanced young person. And in high school, she had this really great, great potential. That, you know, people, you could see her becoming a leader, a senator, maybe even a first woman president. Certainly somebody who would have been involved in the great movements of the 60s, probably, and all of that. And unfortunately, she dies from this horrible accident. But I think White kind of was influenced by her death as well, because her death really was a reminder of him to really kind of, you know, take her spirit and make it part of who he was. And I think it, in some ways, when she died, it reminded him of what his life was really all about. And he had shared that with her, and she had taken it to another level. She was way beyond White in so many ways. You know, young people always are. And so anyway, he really learned from her death. And I think in some ways, some of our historians point out that, you know, his taking on the Klan was probably because of the influence of Mary and her death.
Hmm. Kevin, in doing this film, did you spend some time down at Red Rocks?
Yes, we spent quite a bit of time down there, several shoots down there. And it's a beautiful little place. I mean, it's you can tell that, you know, the Whites had it was a little haven there. And, you know, one of the great things about small town life is that, you know, you could imagine presidents and you know, important writers and different folks coming through there, that was just a powerhouse of just, you know, of energy and thought and you know, I mean, Emporia was very, very lucky to have White. And, you know, every city, every small town that has someone like that in them, in that area, it just changes the whole outlook of the town. And White clearly had that influence on Emporia. And I would argue even that he has that influence on the state. I mean, he made Kansas a more moderate, a more common sense place. And because he was so strong and so powerful in so many ways. And I think it's always been a Republican state, but I think he made Republicans in Kansas a far more moderate force. And the fact that that's not really the case anymore, I think he would be really concerned about that. And that's one of the things that I think is kind of unspoken within the film, is that you see the Kansas that I grew up in, where we had moderate leaders from both parties, and you don't have that anymore.
Many of us know that presidents came to Red Rocks, that those were very heady days for Emporia in terms of just having a lot of the great thinkers of the time come to this small town. How did he make that connection? How is it that this editor from the Emporia Gazette managed to get a national audience?
Well, you know, it really starts with What's the Matter with Kansas? I mean, that was a huge essay, and it really, you know, wins the election for President McKinley. And Teddy Roosevelt is his vice president. McKinley's assassinated. Roosevelt becomes president, and he, because him and Teddy had, he, you know, his a term he always used was Teddy bit me, in terms of the effect that he had on him when he met him, that relationship, and then White's evolution himself, really how he goes into, you know, after the war, as I mentioned, he became far more interested in the First Amendment and civil liberties. And so he evolves and he grows, and he wins that the second Pulitzer Prize for, to an anxious friend. And all of those things just elevated him to another level. And he wrote literature as well. And he's a poet even a little bit. And that just gave him kind of a national status. But more than anything, he just made connections. He was based in Emporia, but he was, you know, often away, and was really kind of an international figure in a lot of ways. And so I think it just grew and grew and grew, and his status as the heart and voice of the Midwest, of the heartland. I mean, that came out of, I mean, he was the guy you went to when you wanted to know how middle of America felt. And that was really just because of his success with those essays and with the To an Anxious Friend and really just this constant drumbeat that he had of, you know, trying to fight for the rights of others.
Kevin, your latest film, William Ellen White, What's the Matter with Kansas, is premiering next week as part of KU's week-long celebration of the 150th anniversary of the birth of William Ellen White. Where can we see it?
It's going to be, it'll be at Wesco at 5:30 on the 25th. So get there early and get a seat. And then it'll be probably on PBS stations in the area here, and then we hope to find a national audience for it as well.
And this is part of their week-long celebration of the 150th anniversary of the birth of William Ellen White. How do you see this film fitting in with some of the panels and some of the speakers that are going to be here that week?
I think it's going to fit in great, because the issues that we deal with in film, you know, fake news, you know, is one of the big, you know, what would White say about fake news? And the whole, you know, relationship between democracy and journalism, and how democracy depends so much on journalism, and that being threatened right now in various ways, and really the whole thing of him taking on the Klan. I mean, he's a journalist, but he takes his journalistic hat off for a moment, becomes a politician, and then is able to go back to being a journalist again. And that's a hard thing to do today. I mean, that's one of the reasons why fake news is this kind of term that gets around now, that's used by certain politicians. And White kind of gives us the example of how to do that. You know, Jim Lehrer is in the film, and he really kind of points out about how, you know, you had the editorial page and then you had the journalistic page, and never the two shall meet. And there were always clear lines between those things. And those lines are a little blurry right now at times. And White knew how to divide those lines and really showed us the way in many ways. And you know, I'm sure the, you know, people at his time probably said, "Oh, you're editorializing or something," but he really didn't. And you can care about issues without having them affect the way you view the facts. And if you just concentrate on the facts, the editorialism can take care of itself in many ways. And so journalism has to really kind of, you know, and we have several great people in the film that really kind of remind us that the facts really matter so much right now. And then the editorial voice can be over here, and the facts and editorialism really shouldn't ever mix.
Kevin Wilmot's latest film is William Ellen White, What's the Matter with Kansas? It's premiering next week at the University of Kansas. Kevin, it is great to talk to you.
Oh, great. Thank you. Thank you so much, Kay.
Kevin Wilmot teaches film at the University of Kansas and is the director of many films, including Jayhawkers and CSA, the Confederate States of America. His latest, William Ellen White, What's the Matter with Kansas, premieres Wednesday, April 25th at KU's Wesco Hall. It's part of the 150th birth year celebration of William Allen White, which includes several events, including a lecture by former Chief White House Photographer Pete Sosa. You can find a complete list of events at journalism.ku.edu/WAW150. We've got more William Allen White coming up. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio.